collaborating for safety, avoiding C-sections, patients rate their hospital stays, and we're going to take a look at some of the deeper issues surrounding pediatric cough and cold medications. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this episode of The Nursing Show. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic, your host, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's program. If you haven't already done so or recently headed over there, you'll want to check out The Nursing Show website at nursingshow.com. The Nursing Show website is a great resource for you. It will provide you links to everything discussed in this and all of the other Nursing Show programs, plus other articles, links, and references placed up there throughout the course of each week. It's a great resource, a place for you to stop by and check out recent articles, all available for you, the nursing community. You'll find that at nursingshow.com, and it is updated frequently, so don't miss out. You'll also find information over there on how you can sign up for the Nursing Show newsletter, and that's a great way to get all of the show notes, links, and information sent to you every single week when the episodes are posted, and also occasionally a couple of other informational posts throughout the course of each month. I want to welcome everyone who's a brand new listener to the show. If you picked up this program over at the iTunes store, don't forget to head back over to the iTunes store. Go ahead and search for The Nursing Show and leave a review of The Nursing Show over there. It's a great way to help out The Nursing Show and help point other listeners towards this resource. So if you like what you hear and want to leave a review, it's always greatly appreciated. At the end of every year, I will be reading off the list of people who've left reviews there. So if you'd like to hear your name here on The Nursing Show at the year-end episode or post it over at The Nursing Show website, you can leave your link over there and review, and you'll be able to see your screen name, your post name over at the iTunes store up in lights here in The Nursing Show. So it's a greatly appreciated opportunity for us to help share with you, and we love to hear back from the listeners on what you like and what you don't like about the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us here, don't forget you can reach us by email at comments@nursingshow.com. And please send your comments, your suggestions for future episode topics, and yes, even your corrections. I'm going to make mistakes from time to time, and it's always good for you to let me know when I misspeak or get my facts wrong so that I can get things straightened out and we can provide the best possible information here for the Nursing Show community. Time now to move on into a look at this week's nursing news, and I'm going to lead off with a story from medicalnewstoday.com. I found this story over there, and it talks about patient safety issues and collaboration between the nurses and the physicians and the entire hospital support services. What was found in this particular study that was conducted by the American Organization of Nurse Executives and Aramark Healthcare, they found that when they interviewed and surveyed 7,400 nurses, they discovered that really the best opportunities for patient safety came when the nurses and other members of the patient care team actively worked with hospital support services, such as the environmental services, clinical technology, food and nutritional services, patient transportation. When everybody was working together, when there was a collaborative effort, and that the nurses acted as what they're calling, quote, a catalyst for the patient care team, that they found that patient safety improved. And this is important as we continue to focus on avoidable injuries, avoidable complications following a hospitalization. This is something that's going to come down to everybody working together to improve the patient care experience and ultimately have healthier patients at the other end. And that's our goal in the long run. So it's interesting that when support service teams became the eyes and ears for the nurses and other caregivers, that they were able to bring things to people's attention, such as signs of possible causes of infection, people that were getting around and looking at different clinical equipment and food services and different things that supported nutrition therapy. You know, the person that comes in and picks up the tray, maybe you're too busy to go in and see that that patient hardly ate anything. Maybe your nutritional support person can come by and say, you know what, for the last 2 days, this patient hasn't eaten anything. Have you noticed that? You know, this improves the patient care process all the way around because we need these patients to be nutritionally supported to heal faster. So these are just some of the examples. I urge you to check out the article in the show notes. Again, this is over at medicalnewstoday.com, and you'll find a link over at nursingshow.com to follow up on this article. I'll move on into a bit of a hot topic, a little bit of a news hot potato, if you will, talking about C-section rates in the United States. Now, this is a very hot issue among nurse midwives, labor and delivery nurses, and women in general, I think. Looking at women who are stalling in the process of labor and how quickly they get moved directly into the C-section line of treatment. How often is that necessary? So this particular study looked at women whose labor stalled and found that perhaps waiting out the delivery process for an extra hour or two could have a positive effect as the labor would continue to progress eventually and the need for a cesarean section was avoided. Now, this was found out at researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, and it's hoped that this could eliminate more than 130,000 C-sections in the U.S. over the course of a year just by waiting out the labor and delivery process a little bit longer. Now, this looked at the outcomes of about 1,000 pregnancies that involved an arrest in the active phase of labor and 2 or more hours without cervical dilation is what they're calling this. And they found that 1/3 of the women actually moved on to a normal delivery without harm for themselves or their child, that the outcomes were all positive, and that the other 2/3 proceeded with a C-section. What does this mean for the rest of us? Well, I'm sure this is nothing new to the L&D nurses out there and the nurse midwives that are listeners of the show. And first of all, I want some of you to contact me. Send an email to comments@nursingshow.com. I'd love to hear from you on your perspectives on this. Is this something that's viable? How optimal is it for you to act as an advocate for your patients in these situations and work with the OBs to extend the time that we wait out these active labor arrest periods? It's something that I'm not really familiar with, so in my field, I'd be deferring to you, but I'd love to hear back your impressions on this particular article. I think if we can avoid surgery and the surgical complications and proceed with labor, that we can avoid a lot of additional hospitalization, a lot of additional complications, and this, of course, bears out according to this study. So I'd look forward to hearing from the nurses out there. So make sure you contact us, leave a comment on the Nursing Show blog at the bottom of the entries for this particular episode, and we'll have a little bit of a discussion on this particular topic. I'm going to wrap up with an article that looks at the patient side of hospital care. How satisfied are our patients with their care when they are hospitalized? We've been talking about patient safety in the news today. We've been talking about waiting out and avoiding extended surgeries and complications and treating different situations a little more patiently. So, what do the patients think about the way they're being cared for? Well, according to a recent article and study released in the New England Journal of Medicine, most patients seem to be satisfied with the care they are receiving, but they are unsatisfied with 2 key areas. And this is something we've talked about here on the show in the past, but I think it bears repeating that this is something that is being confirmed by study after study. Patients are dissatisfied with the communication with their caregivers, and that includes their nurses, but I think it also is focusing on the physicians that are providing communication. But we act as a bridge for that, so we're part of that process, and I think that we need to be willing to step in and help these patients understand a little bit better and require or request that the physicians return and explain themselves again if necessary. Also, the second thing the patients are unsatisfied with is pain control. You know, we focus on pain. I know a lot of us are looking at pain as that additional vital sign. You know, we're getting our pulse, respirations, our blood pressure, pulse ox in some occasions. Are we getting pain ratings consistently on our patients? And are we acting quickly to manage that pain? You know, I know it's difficult. Sometimes you say, you go in, you check on a patient, you're in the middle of doing 10 other things, they say they're in pain, you tell them you'll be right back, and you get back to them with their pain med 20 minutes, 30 minutes later. Well, that's 20 minutes, 30 minutes of additional pain that these patients have. We need to find a way to mitigate that. And sometimes it's not always possible, but definitely controlling their pain is something that everyone is concerned with. It's the thing that we avoid going to the doctor for. So I urge you to read this article and check it out. You can find it in the link in the show notes. It's over at medicalnewstoday.com as well. And you can also check out the article in the New England Journal of Medicine and find out a little bit more about this particular study, and perhaps talk and collaborate with the other caregivers in your facility about ways to better deal with this particular problem. Our segment this week is a special interview segment. With the announcements last month by the FDA of additional scrutiny focusing on pediatric cough and cold medications, and then the follow-up of many of the manufacturers voluntarily changing labeling on those products, I thought it was important for us to get a better handle on what exactly are the problems that are being looked at here. How are we focusing on this, and why has this suddenly become such a hot issue? So I thought we'd focus on our resident toxicologist, and I contacted Lisa Booz over at Maryland Poison Control, and she was happy to sit down with us and explain to us the history of this particular issue and exactly where they expect it to move. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another segment of Tox Tidbits with Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Center. Lisa, welcome back to the show, and I'm greatly interested in hearing what you have for us this time.
Thanks, Jamie. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, I'm sure that you and most of your listeners have heard about the controversies surrounding children's cough and cold medicines. Are they safe? Are they effective? Should they be taken off the market? Poison centers and really all health professionals are being asked a lot of these questions. And so I would just like to take a little bit of time to shed some light on that matter. Over-the-counter cough and cold medicines for children really have been on the market for many, many years. I mean, we all grew up being given these cough and cold medicines, giving our kids these cough and cold medicines, and they typically contain a combination of antihistamines, decongestants, cough suppressants, and sometimes analgesics like acetaminophen can be in there as well. They come in liquid forms, they come in drops, which are usually pretty concentrated forms of these medicines. They come in easy-to-swallow tablets, they come in disintegrating tablets, and they also come in nose sprays. And depending on the product, labels have included dosing recommendations for small children, or they've just recommended to consult a physician if the child is under a certain age. Poison centers receive a lot of calls about small children ingesting these cough and cold medicines. In 2006, there were actually more than 60,000 exposures to cough and cold medicines by children under the age of six. That's a lot. Most exposures are toddlers who pick up the brightly colored liquid, or they'll pick up the fruit-flavored medicine, they'll drink some, they'll eat the tablets. Still others are therapeutic errors. A lot of parents give the wrong dose. They don't measure out the dose properly. They might come along and give a double dose, or they may give several products with the same ingredients. Some cases reported to poison centers also are adverse effects to recommended doses, but that's the minority. Most of them are either the therapeutic errors or kids who just pick up the bottle and drink out of it or eat the tablets out of it. Fortunately, very few children develop severe symptoms, and deaths really are very rare. Now, the controversy about the toxicity in small children was brought to the forefront when a group of physicians led by the Baltimore City Health Commissioner petitioned the FDA in 2006 to remove children's cough and cold medicines from the market. They stated that there are safety concerns, and they also brought to light the fact that there's no proof that these medicines are effective in small children. As a matter of fact, in children older than two, the FDA approval of these cough and cold medicines is based on a review of safety and efficacy data by a panel, a review panel, But other reviews that have looked at children under the age of 2 have concluded that they really are not effective, and they're no more effective than placebo in reducing symptoms of the cold. So this prompted the FDA and manufacturers to take a closer look at whether these products are safe and effective. Soon after the petition, some manufacturers voluntarily withdrew over-the-counter cough and cold medicines that were marketed specifically for use in children less than 2 years of age. These were primarily your infant drops with antihistamines and decongestants, and they were commonly sold under the brand names of Dimetapp, Pediacare, Robitussin, Triaminic, and even a Tylenol brand of cough and cold drops for children. Adding fuel to the fire was a report in January of 2007 by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, commonly we call it the CDC, and that report identified 3 infants less than a year old who had died in 2005, and those deaths were associated with cough and cold medicines. Now, all 3 infants had high levels of pseudoephedrine. That's a commonly used decongestant. We commonly know this as being under the brand name Sudafed. And these infants had high levels in their postmortem blood samples, but the levels were 9 to 14 times the levels expected following therapeutic use of the drugs. So that leads us to conclude or to believe that these infants really had received much higher than recommended doses. More recently, there was a study out of the University of Arizona that identified 10 unexpected infant deaths in 2006 in that state that were somewhat associated with cough and cold medication use. Their toxicology testing revealed evidence that all of the infants had been given cough and cold medicines soon before they died, but only one of those deaths could clearly be attributed to the medicine. The families were generally poor. About 50% of those families had limited English proficiency, and only 4 of those infants received medical care for their current illness before they died. So the authors concluded that the results of their study raised concerns about the safety of the medicines and that the warning on the label to consult a physician before giving to small children really is not being followed by parents, and therein lies one of the big problems. Now, in addition to these reports, a panel of physicians and toxicologists, many of whom are associated with poison centers, determined that almost all of the fatalities reported in children were in children less than 2 years of age. In most of the cases identified, there were contributing factors, including, unfortunately, a number of adults who had given large doses of the medicines for non-therapeutic purposes, such as just to sedate their own child, you know, to put them to sleep. And there were also a lot of dosing errors resulting in too much of the drug being given. So based on that, the panel suggested that maybe cough and cold products really should not be used in children under 2, but they probably should remain available for use in children older than 2. They're much less risk for fatalities and severe symptoms. So after this review of cases, and based on the recommendations of a public advisory committee, the FDA announced in January 2008 that these drugs should not be used in children under the age of 2. So let's fast forward a little bit, a little closer to today, to October 2nd, 2008. It was then that consumer groups really got into the action, and they called on the FDA to pull the children's cough and cold products off the market or to make them available by prescription only. 5 days later, on October 7th of 2008, the makers of children's cough and cold medicines released a statement, and this is across the board, that they were voluntarily changing the labeling to read, "Do not use for children under the age of 4." And an FDA statement the following day stated its support in this decision. So that's where we stand right now. But so what does this mean for the EMS provider, for the nurse, or for other healthcare providers? Well, it's important to understand and reassure parents that severe toxicity and deaths are really very rare unless too much of the drugs are given. And we don't see it really with therapeutic doses of those drugs. Also, that many of the calls to poison centers involve small children who gain access to the product and drink or eat potentially toxic amounts. So it's important to use good poison prevention strategies to keep kids away from these products. So we need to help educate parents also on the proper use of these medicines, how to properly measure out a dose, There are a lot of errors in using medicine cups and syringes, and even teaspoons versus tablespoons. It's also important to recognize that there are alternatives to cough and cold medicines that parents can use and that health professionals can suggest, such as suctioning the nose and using humidifiers instead of using these cough and cold medicines. But one warning, as these medicines are being taken off the market, there may be a chance that there might be more use of more alternative or cultural or herbal type medicines in small children, and they also can be harmful to the infant. So there are a lot of warnings that we need to be aware of, a lot of education that needs to be done to parents and to other caregivers of small children. And we'll see where it goes from here. We'll see what happens in the future.
It sounds to me like education is really the key. I know that one of the things I always really work with patients on is making sure they understand their dosing when we talk about a medication. And for parents, because you're measuring liquids, it's not like an adult form where you're getting a pill and you know to take one pill versus two pills. In a child where you're measuring a liquid medication, really it's incumbent upon the provider, whether it's a nurse or a paramedic or some other medical professional, to actually go over the measurement process with them, to show them how to use the tools properly.
Absolutely, absolutely. We hear of many, many cases where parents just are very confused about how to measure out the dose. And there are products that have very similar names, but they may be different concentrations or different amounts of a particular drug in those products, and so the dosing might be different, and that's very confusing too. So it is important for all of us to sort of get on the bandwagon and make sure that parents know how to use these medicines. And then at the same time, make them aware that they really, in most cases, probably don't need to use the medicines. You know, there are other ways to make their children comfortable without running the risk of making these errors.
Because it really is about treating the symptoms. It's not gonna make the virus go away any faster. We're really about making them comfortable, allowing them to rest and get better on their own, really.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, these medicines are not going to do anything to shorten the time span of the symptoms, just to make the children maybe a little more comfortable. And again, there's evidence that in infants that these medicines probably don't even do that.
Great, Lisa. Well, this is a wonderful topic, and you said you would keep us apprised of any changes and updates to this, so we'll be looking forward to those either segments or text updates on the websites in the future.
I will certainly let you know if I hear of anything more.
I want to thank Lisa again. She's a fantastic resource for us here at The Nursing Show. And if you have any further questions on this topic area, I urge you to contact your own Poison Center. 1-800-222-1222 is the National Poison Center number here in the U.S. And if you want to contact Lisa, you can always catch up with her. Head over to the Maryland Poison Center site at mdpoison.com, and you'll find out all of the information. You can even subscribe to their Tox Tidbits newsletter, and you can also contact Lisa at that site. That's going to wrap up this episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out this week's episode and remind you there are links to everything discussed in this episode available for you over at The Nursing Show site at nursingshow.com. Scroll down on the left-hand side, find the categories section, click on podcasts, and that'll give you links to all of the episode show notes for each episode. Remember, it's your job to follow up on the information. I can provide general information here, both in the news and the commentary, but you need to find out and make it work within your own scope of practice, and that's your job. You can find out more about the terms of service over at nursingshow.com, and you can check out that link on the site. Again, if you'd like to get back in touch with me, don't hesitate to do so. Send us an email at comments@nursingshow.com. We always love to hear from the listeners. Send your comments, suggestions, and corrections. We want to make sure we provide the most factual and up-to-date information for the listeners here in the Nursing Show community. Time to wrap up this episode with some PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This week's episode will close out with a song from the artist Natalie Gelman. We've played her music before, and this particular song is called Never Had You. Check it out and follow her link in the show notes. Let Natalie know you heard her song here on The Nursing Show. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding all of you to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
If I could forget you.